It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The late-night television talk show landscape is set to change in the coming months, and the changes come as the future of the late-night format is in question. Earlier this year, James Corden announced he'll be leaving the Late Late Show next spring. More recently, Trevor Noah said he's stepping away from The Daily Show in December. Last year, Conan O'Brien ended his 28-year run as a late-night host, and TBS got out of the talk show wars entirely with the cancellation of Full Frontal with Samantha Bee this summer. The changes come as traditional late-night talk show television ratings have been declining since the heydays of Jay Leno and David Letterman in the 1990s. As more and more viewers and video content switch to online streaming, it leaves an unclear future for late-night talk shows that once dominated American popular culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch late-night talk shows yourself in real time, or do you watch funny bits when they pop up on some form of social media or YouTube the next day? Were these kind of shows once part of your regular viewing at night, whether we're going back to Carson or Leno or Letterman or pick your era? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. John Koblin is a media reporter for the New York Times covering the TV industry. He's co-author of the book, It's Not TV, The Spectacular Rise, Revolution, and Future of HBO. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob, for having me on.
Before we get into some of the specific changes lately, can you talk about the big picture trends that led from, you know, the only game in town pretty much was talk shows at late night for a long time, and now not so much?
Yeah, you know, you did a great job summing up all these departures that are coming up. And this has happened in late night before. In 2014 and 2015, we saw Jay Leno, Dave Letterman, and Jon Stewart all depart at relatively, in a sort of truncated period of time. And at that point, 7 or 8 years ago, the entire television industry and news media was interested in on the short list. Who's going to replace these hosts? There's something different about these departures this time. When James Corden announced he was leaving, the president of CBS said, we're not going to stick with the same old, host behind a desk format. We're going to think about something else. And Trevor Noah's replacement for The Daily Show, that might be a multi-host reformatted show as well. When you talk to producers in the late night field, they say that there's something different this time. And the something different, diminished ratings, less revenue. NBC is considered spinning off Seth Meyers' 12:30 show on NBC. They've considered spinning that off to MSNBC. So it's a pretty challenged genre. And I think it is fair to ask the question at this point, what is the future of the late night show?
Yeah, the content of late night shows doesn't necessarily fit well with streaming, right? The Game of Thrones, say you watch that when it first breaks or 2 days later or 2 years later, still the same show. That topical monologue at the beginning of a late night show doesn't make sense 2 days or 2 weeks later.
Yeah, this is probably the biggest challenge. As we've seen with both scripted entertainment and even unscripted entertainment, it has made the transition from network television, cable television, to streaming very, very nicely. Late night shows depend on topicality. They depend on what people are talking about that day, or at least within the last few days. And that is not how people experience streaming entertainment. Netflix was really, they really made a hard effort to make a talk show work 5-6 years ago. They gave a talk show to Chelsea Handler. They gave one to Joel McHale. They gave one to Hasan Minhaj. None of them worked, and all of them were canceled. Hulu, similarly, they gave a show to Sarah Silverman. That was canceled after only a handful of episodes. Apple TV Plus, they just gave a show to Jon Stewart. The second season recently began, but the first season really had a tough time garnering significant attention. So late night, as we know it, going back to the Johnny Carson days and then evolved by David Letterman and then spun forward by Conan O'Brien and Jimmy Fallon and Stephen Colbert, that show where you have a host who does a monologue, sits behind the desk, does a funny sketch, does a celebrity interview, that just does not work on streaming.
Before he announced he was leaving The Daily Show, Trevor Noah was asked by an audience member what he thought the future of late-night comedy would look like. Here's what he said.
Content is evergreen, right? There will always be content. I think when we consume content, will change. Like, some people go, this is a late-night show. Some people don't think of it as a late-night. They just go, it's a show. Then some people don't even think of it as a TV show. They go, like, I love your show on YouTube. I love your show on TikTok. I love you on Snapchat. I love you on Facebook. I love, like, there's some people who go, if I go, like, I have a TV show, they're like, what TV? Where? And they have no clue at all. My brother taught me this, my younger brother. He doesn't watch TV at all, but he's seen everything that's on TV.
Do you see that changing the content, John, where, okay, as opposed to doing something that's going to work in my live broadcast, I'm going to do something that's going to work for people to click on YouTube or Instagram or whatever?
Yeah, I think we saw that change when Jimmy Fallon took the reins of The Tonight Show in 2014. He really was creating content for it to go viral on YouTube. James Corden as well. That's where Carpool Karaoke began and became a huge hit. It became a huge hit on YouTube and not necessarily on CBS. The difference between now and then is the ratings have fallen even farther from where they were 8 years ago. And most significantly, the revenue has diminished. Most producers I talk to believe the genre will continue in some way in 5 or 10 years. It's just going to look radically different than it does today, mostly because we have to figure out how does this work on the internet? How does this work digitally?
We're talking with New York Times media reporter John Coblin about changes in late night talk shows and where they could go from here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What role do you think the late night talk show plays in American culture, or played past tense in American culture? Is there one you still watch live, or do you catch up the next day on? Fill in the blank there. Did you used to consistently watch one of the late night talk show hosts? Who was your favorite from the days of yore, whether that was 3 years ago or 30 years ago? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with, here's John Coblin, media reporter for the New York Times, who covers the television industry. With us today, looking at changes coming to late night TV talk shows and the challenges those programs face in the streaming age. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think the future holds for late night talk shows? What question you have about the changes that have been happening that may be coming in the future? Do you care who replaces James Corden on The Late Late Show, Trevor Noah on The Daily Show, or if those shows go away altogether? Was there a show in the past that, yeah, you really watch that all the time? What changed for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller. Mike is with us in Waukesha. Mike, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Mike?
So it was interesting. I'm just driving on my way here in Waukesha, Wisconsin. I got to go pay a bill. But we were talking about why the late night people like Trevor Noah and why these shows are, let's say, being off the air, canceled, what have you. I have a suspicion that it's content as it relates to what people are calling the woke agenda and the woke mentality, in which late night used to be entertaining. It used to be funny. It even provided a little bit of variety. If you ask me, you know, the days of Carson, even Letterman, Leno. But what you didn't see the political push, it seems. And there's a saying out there. It says, get woke, go broke. While other people on YouTube and on Internet are doing quite well, the Rogans, the Tim Pools, Jordan Peterson, Russell Brand, they're growing. They're huge. So I don't necessarily think it's technology somewhat. I just think it's content, really.
Mike, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. We had another caller who was also worried about politics on these shows, liberal politics, they said, sneaking in. What do you think, John?
I mean, it cannot be discounted. Obviously, it's a factor. You know, ever since much the way America has gone, late night television is gone. Once things started getting more divisive, and particularly when Donald Trump entered the fray in 2015 and then won the election in 2016, we've seen many of the late night hosts take on a more political bent to their shows, particularly Stephen Colbert, who's the most watched host in late night. His show has become a very political show that it cannot be discounted. It absolutely has to be considered a factor if you are turning off potentially half the audience. However, we also cannot discount the really the technological, the seismic technological shift. I mean, Rob, I was smiling when you came back from break and you're playing the Tonight Show theme. You know, that when the Tonight Show was on, when Johnny Carson was hosting it, when Jay Leno hosted it, you had America watching NBC from 8 to 11 p.m., watching their local news at 11, and then they just transitioned right into Johnny at 11:30. You had millions of people doing that every night. Those habits are broken permanently. You do not have even close to the same number of viewers watching NBC or CBS or ABC between 8 and 10, 11, between 8 and 11 p.m. And if you have fewer people to begin with, you have fewer people sticking around for 11:30 and 12:30.
Is there, do you see any way to bring back that kind of common language again, where people are saying, hey, did you see who was on Carson last night or something like that? Or is that something we just can't go back to, given all the variety out there?
I think it's extremely possible. And many of the late night producers and former producers who I spoke to are optimistic that something could work. One producer posited an interesting solution to me. Now, Thursday Night Football is on the Amazon streaming service. You have 10, 11, 12 million people who are up watching it on Amazon every week. When that ends, is there some sort of show that Amazon could put on, a topical live show afterwards, where people stick around for another hour? Is it going to look like the traditional late night show? No, but could you bring elements of the genre into something like that for sort of this big event programming, especially as it slowly makes its transition to streaming? That is a compelling theory, and it could work.
Now, with the couple changes we mentioned, Trevor Noah and James Corden, each on their shows for about 7 years before announcing their departures, here's a Corden talking to the entertainment news program Extra about the length of his stay on the show.
By the time we finish, I'll have done pretty much like 1,400 episodes. That's a lot. And I know that in America, these jobs are positions that people take for 10, 15, 20, 25 years. It was never, ever going to be that for me.
Yeah, who'd want to host the same talk show for more than 7 years? I don't know about that. But this idea, I mean, it used to be like, you know, you're the Pope almost. This is a lifetime appointment once you landed that late night gig. And now it seems like, I don't know, a lot of the hosts have other things they could do out there.
Yeah, that's another big part of this. As we've learned with both the Corden and Trevor Noah departures, they don't see it as a lifetime appointment and they don't want a lifetime appointment. Trevor Noah, when he broke the news to viewers that he was leaving The Daily Show, he had told very few people that he was doing that. Much of his staff didn't know, and more significantly, his bosses didn't know. He completely blindsided them, and I think it was because he just wanted to get it out of the way, announce his departure on his terms so he could leave within a couple months, and he will be gone by December. Yeah, I mean, it's a grind. These are very hard jobs, and these hosts have a lot more options now. Take Conan O'Brien. Conan O'Brien had been in late night for nearly three decades. His show on TBS, they reformatted it within the last 2 years of its life, reducing it to a half hour and focusing on one guest for an interview. It didn't work. The ratings were really, really, really low for that show. But guess what happened? Conan O'Brien had a side project going. He had a podcast, a long-form interview program, interviewing other celebrities or journalists or interesting people. That is a huge hit. It's a huge hit. And Conan O'Brien just sold his podcast network to SiriusXM. So it really was a matter of genre, where Conan O'Brien was doing it. Late night wasn't working, but podcast does.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us in San Jose, Costa Rica. Paul, hi.
Hello, hello. Greetings.
What did you want to bring up, Paul?
Frequent listener from abroad. I've lived abroad for decades. I always watch the shows you're talking about. I watch them online. Thank God that they're streamed so I can see them, because I wouldn't have access to them otherwise. So I think a lot of us watch those shows, whether it's the entire show of Colbert or Trevor Noah, or we're just clicking on the interviews and pieces that we want to see, and I would be really upset to lose them. Much less, I don't agree that it's about woke content at all. I think they're always topical, and they keep me abreast of what's going on, and I enjoy the humor, and it's part of my day to always check in with them.
And Paul, I got to ask, you mentioned sometimes you just click on interviews. Do you ever watch, you know, in real time, live, when those shows are broadcast?
I never do. I don't know that I ever have.
Gotcha. Paul, thanks a lot for sharing that. Interesting perspective there, John, on how he uses that.
Completely. I you know what? He is like a lot of people out there. There are thousands and millions of people who are going to go ahead and click on a YouTube of what was Colbert's monologue last night. Oh, I heard Jimmy Fallon had Olivia Wilde on his show last night. I will watch that. And this worked for a while because there were enough viewers coming into the broadcast network where the network executives were happy. They were making plenty of money. And sure, let it be a hit on YouTube. The problem is simply the economics. You're making pennies on the dollar with those YouTube clicks. They just, if the viewers are not tuning in at high numbers into the network, the YouTube stuff just doesn't make economic sense. And these media companies have done a better job at moving a lot of this content to their own proprietary streaming services. But again, you know, how many subscribers are you going to get because you want to watch Stephen Colbert, you watch Jimmy Fallon? It may not be enough to justify the expenses of these shows. And these shows cost a lot of money. They could cost anywhere on a yearly basis between $60 and $100 million to produce.
Let's bring on another caller now. Richard is with us in Two Rivers. Richard, hi.
Yeah, hi.
What did you want to bring up, Richard?
I want to bring up the fact that, I'm talking to some other people right now.
Oh, okay. I'll let you go then, Richard. Let's go to Charles in Merrill. Charles, hi.
Hi there. I was wondering what your guest thought of John Oliver's show. I don't know if he'd consider it a late night show or not, but he has, you know, kind of exactly what the last caller was talking about. Lots of topical, societal and political, you know, topics on videos on YouTube that are fantastic. I think he's on HBO, and we've considered getting HBO because we love his show so much.
Interesting, Charles. You've written a bit, I think, John, about HBO. Thoughts on John Oliver and if he would actually be, you know, getting people to subscribe?
It's such a great question, Charles. I would say John Oliver is kind of the exception to the rule here, but he does something different, right? He's a weekly show, and he's not on 52 weeks a year. It's less than that, but it's a weekly show. It's a 30-minute show, and he usually does a little, you know, song and dance. He does, like, you know, does some comedy bits at the top, but it's usually a single topic. And it's kind of a journalistic show, too. But for the purposes of the genre, I do think it counts as a late-night show. In fact, it has won the Best Variety Talk Show Emmy Award, I believe, 7 years in a row, beating Colbert, beating Kimmel, beating Seth Meyers, year in and year out. I think one of the things that benefited John Oliver is his show started before the streaming era really began to dominate entertainment. It started as an HBO proper show. So I think he has successfully made the transition to the other side, where plenty of people are watching him on HBO Max, even if not as many people are watching him on HBO, the cable network. But John Oliver is an example of a success story here.
And speaking of shows that, like, do they fit the genre? People have pointed toward Greg Gutfeld on Fox News. So it's a more conservative leaning sort of talk show on a network where people, you know, the built-in audience would match up well with that. Where does that fit into this discussion?
It's a late night political and comedy show, and it is definitely worked. I mean, you know, Fox has, it's an 11 p.m. show. Fox has done a number of experiments at 11 p.m., and this is the one that's taken hold. Many network executives sort of bristle at the comparison that Gutfeld is the same genre as what they're doing. Notably, they will point out that he is live at 8 p.m. on the West Coast, so he gets the Goose's numbers even more. And also, Fox viewers are very loyal to their network. They will stay from afternoon until night. So there is a smooth transition from Tucker to Laura Ingraham to Hannity to Gutfeld.
Now, Bringing Things Around, you recently co-wrote a piece headlined, Is There a Future for Late Night Talk Shows? What are you watching for in the future? Is there going to be a late night talk show, or are we going to translate this all into, I don't know, YouTube and podcast video series? What are you watching for in the future?
In the short term, let's see who replaces Trevor Noah. Let's see who replaces James Corden. I suspect both Comedy Central and CBS are going to try to shake up the format. Not many networks have tried to shake up the format. So let's see if those efforts are successful. I have a careful eye on Stephen Colbert's contract is up next year. Does he re-sign? If he re-signs, is it a short 1 or 2 year deal, or is it a 3-4 year deal? The Tonight Show, NBC is considering giving up its 10 p.m. primetime hour and giving it to local affiliates. Does the Tonight Show move up to 10:30 or 11 p.m. if so? And does that work? Do more viewers come in to watch it? And similarly, what happens to Seth Meyers at 12:30? It's a popular show. It's a niche show, but it always gets critical recognition. Does that continue to run at 12:30, or do NBC executives decide to put it on their streaming service or on their cable news network?
And finally, John, if I'm watching TV after 10 o'clock, it's either I'm still watching a live sporting event, or I'm pulling up something to stream, probably, a TV show of some sort, fictionalized TV show. Are people like me killing this late night talk show format?
Luckily, you're not alone, so we don't have to single you out, Rob. Simply, yes. We are collectively really getting it closer to life support because we're just not watching the way we did 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
John, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
John Coblin is a media reporter for the New York Times covering the television industry. He was with us today looking at the present and future of late night television talk shows in the streaming age. Still time for you to share your thoughts, maybe your all-time favorite. If you had one you watched reliably every night, if you could, let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And if at first you don't succeed, you know how the saying goes, try again. And there could be a link there. Here's a poem, Try Again by William Edward Hickson. If you find your task is hard, try again. Time will bring you your reward, try again. All that other folks can do, why with patience should not you? Only keep this rule in view, try again. Time will bring you your reward for continuing to do an activity that you may not be that great at. But what are our options when we begin but fail, strive but fall short, give up, try something else? What's really in it for us to persevere? We want to hear from you this half hour at 1-800-642-1234. Does this sound like you? Have you recently tried something new, a new sport, a new activity, a hobby, and how did you find it? Were you a master of your craft right out of the gate, or did you strike out like the Brewers did this season? Any backup? Give it another go? You tell me how it went for you at 1-800-642-1234. Our guest is Rachel Feinzig. She is the work and life columnist for the Wall Street Journal, and she recently wrote an amazing article about all of this in a column for the Journal called The Case for Allowing Yourself to Be Bad at Something. Rachel, thank you for allowing me to be bad at so many things.
Thank you so much for having me. I could spend the whole half hour just talking about all the things I'm bad at.
Right, that's what I was thinking is I'm going to have to refrain, and we'll just give out the phone number again and hope others will participate and let us know what they're not so good at 1-800-642-1234. Please, you tell us so we don't have to tell you. And Rachel, what inspired you to write this column?
So I was at a yoga class with a colleague and friend this past summer. I am a runner and I got injured. So I was like that girl, you know, that injured runner in the yoga class trying to fit in with all the experienced yogis. I am so bad at yoga. And I said to my friend, like, I hope after the class, I hope you weren't watching me. And she told me two things. One, no, I wasn't watching you. Like, I don't care, which I think is an important takeaway for all of this. But the second thing she said was, you know, my husband won't even come to yoga with me. He won't do anything that he's not great at. And I just immediately knew I had to write a column about this and why we are so bad at being bad at things.
Well, and how do you get good if you're not bad at it first? And maybe that says more about me than anything else, Rachel, but I certainly had to wonder when I read your article, how does anybody start out of the gate being so brilliant and being able to dance so well? Doesn't
completely
happen, does it?
No. And I recounted my yoga story to someone that I talked to for the story. She's actually a professional mountain biker. And her response was like, what did you expect was going to happen to you at yoga class? Like, people spend years trying to master this stuff. And it often comes with periods of getting worse or staying stagnant. Like, progress is not linear and doesn't come in this kind of like lockstep, you know, way that we expect. And so, yes, I think you're completely, completely right. It's totally normal to be bad at something, especially at first.
Rachel Feinzig from the Wall Street Journal looked into this for us, and I believe at some level we could all relate. What are you bad at? 1-800-642-1234. And Rachel, as you write in the Wall Street Journal, that you heard more profanity while interviewing for this story than you did when you actually did a story about profanity.
I was so quiet. I could not believe how upset and like deeply emotionally affected people were as they told me these stories about their failings, about things, you know, that oftentimes were like fairly inconsequential, just in the sense that they were hobbies, things they were doing for pleasure, not like I have messed up this massive part of my life. And yet they were just torn and tortured about it, really.
And it feels that way, and it sounded that way from the interviews and the curse words you couldn't use for your story, Rachel. But it goes towards, and you write about this, social perfectionism, the trend of social perfectionism, that we have to be great. There is no room for error here. But those trends are changing, aren't they?
Yeah, that's what I felt like really made this an important story to tell right now. This idea that all of us have become more perfectionistic over the years. There is research that's been done on this, analyzing students. We all fall somewhere on this kind of scale of perfectionism, and the average is just shifting more to the right, more toward, yeah, that kind of no tolerance for failure, obsessed with how other people are perceiving us. This idea, they call it social perfectionism. And I mean, there's a lot of reasons for it that we can talk about, but I think it makes a story like this just way more pertinent in this moment.
So you are way out of balance at a yoga class and you think everybody is looking at you, even though they're doing the downward dog. So couldn't even see you unless they were doing the position incorrectly. But there is this sense that, oh my gosh, everybody's looking at me. And the reality is everybody's kind of thinking about that themselves, aren't they? That you're not on a stage.
Oh, completely. And we're all just totally self-obsessed as humans. I don't even mean that in like a bad way, but you know, we're worried about how we look as compared to kind of picking apart other people, especially in a situation like this where it's just a yoga class. Like, I wanted to talk to people about all parts of their lives, and certainly some of it was about work, but some of it was just about this kind of plethora of hobbies that people have or side interests. And it was just fascinating to see how people thought about being watched and being viewed.
Mm-hmm. So right now, I want to know what you're bad at. Or if you don't think you're bad at anything, I'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234 with our guest, Rachel Feinzig, who is the work and life columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Let's go to Marcia in Stevens Point this afternoon. Marcia, you're on Central Time.
Yes, I'd just like to tell you that I don't consider I'm bad at anything because I do not have an inner critic.
Well, what's that like?
Well, it's fabulous because I don't have to feel bad all the time.
So dancing, singing, it doesn't matter. Ice fishing, there's no way. I mean, you're good at it, or you just don't have anybody telling you that it doesn't matter?
I never considered it matter. If I have fun doing something, what's the difference whether I'm doing it as good as the next person?
If you're having fun doing something, who cares how good you are at it? Rachel, that really resonates with me.
I love that. We should all, me especially. Marsha's my new therapist. What a great place.
Exactly. And so as I think of this, if how do you get rid of that inner critic? Marsha doesn't seem to have ever had it, which I would think might be a blessing and a curse, but how do you shake it?
I think part of it is just embracing the fact that you're a beginner, like telling yourself, reminding yourself that people like helping beginners. It just being kind of honest about it and asking for help can make other people feel like they're the experts.
Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist for the Wall Street Journal. And going back to the idea that everybody's watching you, you talked to a business owner, Elliot Pepper, for your story in the Wall Street Journal, and he had some glaring discrepancies. There were some things he was not great at, but he didn't want to admit it, and it cost him, at least business-wise, on his bottom line. Once he realized that he was able to fill the gaps and do so, his quote was, "People don't care that much." People don't care that much, Rachel.
I know. I love that quote. And I thought it was a really fascinating example because he would go to these networking events for entrepreneurs, you know, where people kind of offer helpful tips, and people would ask, you know, how's he doing? And he would just,
great.
He'd just say, "I'm killing it." I'm like, but he couldn't, you know, admit his failings, which were not really about like the substance of his business. He's an accountant and a financial planner, and he knew the ins and outs of all these complicated things, but he couldn't handle things like, you know, collecting on invoices. And so, you know, for him, the answer came from finding a business partner who was A, good at the things he wasn't good at, and B, who he felt comfortable opening up to and learning from. And that kind of just solved the problem.
Let's go to Pat in Green Bay with things we're not so great at and why that might not matter at 1-800-642-1234. Pat, good afternoon.
Afternoon, folks. Thank you for accepting my phone call.
Thanks for calling. What do you got?
All right. So my thing that I am just horrible at is reading people.
That's got to be rough, Pat.
Well, okay, to put it in context, I have, as I like to call it, my side hustle. I'm practicing for retirement. I create wooden wares, so wooden spoons, you know, utensils, mm-hmm. things like that. So I'm always trying to look in the magic crystal ball of, what do people want next year? Well, right, I've been doing this for three years. I still don't have it right.
Well, it's just 3 years, Pat. I think you got to give it 30. And even after that, how, I mean, human behavior, that you've really, who would be very good at that, Pat? I would be interested to meet the person who would be very good at that. Rachel, so great with wooden wares, but not easy to figure out what wooden wares people are going to want.
I mean, it reminds me of the Elliot Pepper story, right? Where you're good at doing the thing and and there's this other skill set that's not really central to the doing of the thing that you're missing. So I feel like it's something where you could, you know, just ask someone else for help. And I also think it just goes back to the point of like you said, it's only been 3 years. Everything takes longer than we think it will to get right. It's been my experience.
Rachel Feinzig, that has been mine as well. She is our guest and a work and life columnist for the Wall Street Journal, discussing how bad people are at being bad at things. We should get better at being bad, is what we're saying. We don't like it. Rachel's found, and she's here to tell us, keep on trying that thing anyway, especially if it's fun. As Marsha pointed out, if it's fun, what's the point of the rest, right? 1-800-642-1234, your chance to share with us what you're so bad at. Why that just doesn't matter. We'll continue the conversation next on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're continuing our talk with Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist for The Wall Street Journal, talking about a recent column of hers for the journal titled The Case for Allowing Yourself to Be Bad at Something. And it turns out we're just not that good at being bad. And we're looking for your input this afternoon on what you're bad at and why that might not matter at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, where Jeff in Superior is standing by. Jeff, what are you bad at?
Good afternoon. I'm 62 years old, and I've spent a lot of money in my lifetime trying to become good at carving pumpkins.
Like just the nose and the eyes, or the elaborate three? Yeah.
You know, those young women in their 20s and 30s, they're so effortless. You know, they can do it for the kids. But I don't have that flair, that intuition, or that whatever je ne sais quoi they have. But they seem to do – their pumpkins are perfect. And I destroy a pumpkin when I try to make it. I try to carve it, and it's. I feel sad. I feel sorry for the pumpkin, but
wait,
I keep trying.
Now, is this something you only do during Halloween season, or is this a year-round practice that you've developed until you put in the hours to become good at it?
Oh, I'm still not good at it. I've put in hours. I've lived in community. I've lived with people. I've even tried to bring this privately, so I'm not embarrassing myself.
Wow.
But I keep trying to make a pumpkin that I can say, doggone it, that's a darn good pumpkin.
Well, wrong time of year to be terrible at pumpkin carving, Jeff, but I very much appreciate the call. And Rachel Feinzig, it's interesting because sometimes being great at something isn't that great. And you talk to a pro BMX biker about what it means to be perfect at being a BMX biker, and it just didn't seem, at least for the person that you interviewed, to be fun.
I think it can take a lot of the fun out of it.
Yeah.
I mean, he told me, you know, for him now, because he decided not to go that route of being a professional BMX biker, you do a trick one time, you do it and you enjoy it. And being a professional, you have to do it 100 times until there's no possible way that you could not get it right. And I mean, it wears on people. He found that it was much more sustainable to just keep it as a hobby versus risking injury. He found that a lot of professional BMXers had trouble with money and addiction. And I think there's a sense that keeping something fun oftentimes means not obsessing over perfecting it.
Mm-hmm. And you do it so often that it's muscle memory, that you could do it in your sleep. And once you're doing it in your sleep, where's the fun in that?
I mean, it becomes a job, right? A reason to get paid for jobs because no matter how great they are, they're still not that fun.
Let's turn now to Paul in Northern Illinois. Paul, you're on Central Time with Rachel Feinzig.
Hi, you've inspired me to pivot just a hair, even though my main thing is yet to come. My dad was a professional drummer, played for Frank Sinatra, the Rat Pack, and when I was a young teen aspiring to be just like him, he said, don't do it. You're going to discover that the music business is just going to eat you alive, and it won't make you happy. So I keep drums as a hobby.
Yeah.
And I agree with that previous statement. But my thing that I'm really bad at is reading a room. And I feel like my mission in life is to build bridges and connect people. So I don't mind if I kind of play the fool sometimes in order for people to either get a laugh at my expense or just connect.
So, and this is the second time we've heard this, Paul, and and I can relate to it too. Sometimes it's difficult to relate to people. It's tough to know what they want or where they want to go with it. And sometimes it's not easy to read a room. Rachel, we've heard this a couple times now, and it's an interesting take on and a little bit different than your article.
Right. This idea that people are an enigma. I mean, I think it's true. And I think it's probably especially true in this moment after the pandemic, right? I think a lot of people are probably feeling like they have trouble reading a room or connecting to people in the right way or not being awkward, you know, as we kind of like totally gear up and go back to, you know, some semblance of what things were like in 2019.
And I want to go back to a moment, this idea that we don't like being bad at something because we have this sense that we're being watched or that there is an audience. And I wonder if we were bad at something and there was an audience, whether or not there'd be a change in society. If there was,
you know, I am a bad dancer. And so if I were to bad dance in front of anybody, whether or not, that would make it a little bit easier for all the other bad dancers in the world to shake their tail feather.
Oh, totally. I can't remember who, but someone I was talking to for the piece was like, is there anything better than watching someone just leave it all out on the dance floor? Especially when they're just doing their own thing and it's not like they're some professionally trained like ballroom dancer. I think it leaves room for way more like joy, and it gives other people permission to just be themselves. And one other benefit that we haven't talked about yet, but that I heard from a surfer who I talked to for this piece was, you know, in so many parts of our lives, we have to be the leader, the one who's helping other people. She talked about how freeing it was to not have to be good at surfing, to not feel that pressure. It's just can be really liberating.
And we put this up on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We asked people about the stuff they tried and were bad at it and what happened. We got a response from Pete who said, I took guitar lessons earlier this year, started off great, but once we got into chords, I struggled. Wasn't putting in the practice time I needed, and then when the summer came, I said I was too busy to continue the lessons, but I wish I had learned guitar. And Pete got a supportive response from Paul on Facebook who says, get back to the guitar, guy. Chords are not that bad if just learn the basic ones. He says, I struggled too, but my daughter encouraged me to get back at it. And now I play in jam bands on Saturdays. Well, get back at it. And you know what's interesting? I've tried to play guitar too, and the one thing I realized is it hurts. You need calluses to do that. So right out of the gate, it's not something you're going to be good at no matter what. But there is this sense that, you know, if you stick with it, you'll be at least good enough to not have to hide it. Right?
Well, yeah. And I also think that there oftentimes does have to be a certain level of being good at something to have it be enjoyable. So to reach that, like, you know, something of a flow state where you feel like you're doing it, like the surfer that I talked to, I mean, ideally, like to get up on a wave, you know, is like this exhilarating feeling, or to be good enough in the water that you can paddle out and be there experiencing it. So, I mean, I'm all for being bad at things too, but I do understand this idea that, you know, I think that for me, if I was just better at yoga, I could do more of the poses and I would be in more of like a flow state, you know, during the class.
So have you gotten back to yoga, Rachel?
No, I totally have given up and just gone back to running. I it's true. I ran away from the yoga as I could.
I've given up on guitar too, and it turns out I'll just have soft fingers and that'll be the way it's going to be. But since you published your story in the Wall Street Journal, what kind of feedback have you received? Have you heard more bad stuff?
Yes, golf has been a big theme for people. A lot of people feeling bad about their golf game. All kinds of things that I haven't even thought of. People have told me about their hobbies, things that they ditched, and then things that they, you know, pursued and eventually got great at. You know, I think photography was mentioned. It's been fascinating to hear people's. I really feel like it goes to the heart of how we feel about ourselves as humans.
Yeah, and I feel there's like a Venn diagram here somewhere where if we're bad at a thing but we enjoy the thing, it's a good idea to keep doing it. But if we're bad at it and don't like it, then we don't need to keep doing it at all. And should we keep doing it and holding out for something to turn around? What do you think?
I think only if you really want to. I think, like I said, reaching that flow state, if it's something where you really think the payoff is going to be there, like some things just are kind of miserable to learn. Snowboarding, for example, you are like on your butt and it is cold and it costs a lot of money. But I think you do, if it's something that's important to you, that you really feel in your gut that you've always wanted to do. And I heard that from a lot of people. I heard that from so many people. I always wanted to do this. And only now that I'm like 70 years old and in retirement, did I give it a go. And it's as great as I thought. It's like, don't wait until retirement, you know?
Right. Rachel, I would ask you, what advice would you give for someone who's struggling either with a new skill or an old skill or something that they've left behind but still think about and considering giving it up or picking it up? But again, what would you say to them?
I would set a timeline and just totally embrace the fact that you're going to be bad for the first like X period of time. Give yourself, if it's snowboarding, like give yourself X number of lessons, and you know you're going to be bad, and you're going to go in there to the instructor and say like, I'm bad, but not in like a self-deprecating, like, you know, like fishing for compliments way, in like a, I invite your help and expertise kind of way. And I so appreciate like what you can do, your talents. I think that having that attitude for a set period of time is a good way to go.
Rachel Feinzig, thank you for making us feel that bad can be so good.
Thank you so much for having me.
Work and Life columnist for The Wall Street Journal.